Thank you all for joining on this December 25th, Asar B'Teves. Obviously, somewhat of an awkward coincidence here that our legal holiday shiur falls out on a fast day, but we're pushing through anyway, and Baruch Hashem, it's on Zoom, so no one has to trek through the snow to get to the class. But most importantly, thank you to all of us for sponsoring in memory of our dear friend Larry Schoen. Levish Bebel Ben Yisrael Zisha passed away a few weeks ago, and we're still all thinking of him, and we're still all missing his contributions, his presence in shul, and everything he did for the shul, and his children continue to do for the shul. It's wonderful to have such an opportunity now to sort of remember him in a way that he would have really loved. He would have loved talking about sports and Torah, the two things he probably cared about, probably his top five interests in life, probably behind his family. You know, his family, then comes Torah, and then comes sports. If anybody knew Larry, you knew how much he loved sports. He took me personally to sporting events. I think he took me to both a Lions game and to a Tigers game, neither of which were particularly entertaining. And if it wasn't for Larry being there, I'm not sure I would have enjoyed it. So I have him to thank for that, and I know he would have loved the topic. So this is why we chose to talk about a little bit of the intersection of sports and halacha, or sports and Judaism. It's going to be a little bit of a history heavy class. You know, usually with these classes in the legal holiday classes, we like to really mix together some history along with some interesting halachic dilemmas, right? We talked last week about some of the halachic nuances or discussions, debates of early American communities when they had to discuss kashrus in terms of chicken, in terms of turkey, things like that. But today is really a little more history, right? There's not a lot of halacha that goes into the background of the Jews who played sports. I'm going to try to do a little digging for next week in terms of Jewish pride in sports and when, you know, the situations where people took off because they were doing Rosh Hashanah or they're doing Yom Kippur. They didn't play sports, showing where their priorities lied. But I'm not really sure in terms of the background, in terms of the halacha, what comes up in that. But maybe we could do a little halacha then. We're going to do halacha today also. To start off the class, we're going to do a little bit of background in terms of Judaism and sports in general. And then we'll get into a little bit of the early origins of, I would say, either discrimination or opposition to Jewish sporting events, Jewish sporting clubs. We'll talk about that soon. Let me share my screen here, or at least this share my document here to get you up to speed with what I'm showing. I don't know if people can see this. Oh, okay, I think now you can see it. We're going to talk a little bit just to start. You know, don't be intimidated by the sources here. Let me zoom in for anyone who can't see it as well. How do I zoom in? My young eyes aren't usually... There we go. Okay, hopefully that's a little bit better for people. So here we have an interesting background, because when you think of Judaism, you know, even when I introduced the class at the end of davening just a few minutes ago, so I said we're going to talk about Jews and sports. So the guy said, "Oh, it's going to be a 5-minute class." Because obviously Jews are not usually the ones that are playing the sports. Jews are usually the ones that are managing the sports, or they're the ones, dealing with the operations of athletes and healing the athletes. They're not typically the athletes themselves. The question is that simply by happenstance? Is that just sort of our genetic pool that we're not the most athletic group? Or is there something more behind it in terms of hashkafa, in terms of halacha? So the truth is there's a very, very limited amount of information about this. The Gemara doesn't usually, use up its ink discussing the ins and outs of sporting events. You know, maybe it would have been interesting to know what kind of sporting events were going on back then, but we don't have much. But from what we do have, there's an interesting discussion in a couple places that really, that sort of indicates to us or implies to us how Chazal or how the rabbis viewed sporting bets. If you look at the first source here, so this is a Rashi on a Gemara in Sukkah. The Gemara in Sukkah, or the Mishnah in Sukkah, really tells us that on the last day of Sukkot, on Hoshana Rabbah, when they finished using the lulav, so then something happened where they took the lulav and they used it for other things. So you see it here in Rashi, in source number one, he quotes the Gemara, the Mishnah that says, Miyad hatinokos shomtines lulavehen. So it's unclear what exactly that means. Miyad tinokos. From the hands of the children, they took the lulavs. So what does that mean? Says Rashi, Hagdolim shomtin es lulave hakatanim miyadam bashvi. The older kids would take the lulav of the younger kids on the seventh day of Hoshana Rabbah. This presumably being because the lulavs of the children weren't really designated for mitzvah, so maybe you could do other things with them. So now the Gemara is saying, now the Mishnah is saying that the older kids took the lulavs of the younger kids. And then what happened? Va'ochlin esrogehen. And then the older kids would eat the esrogim of the younger kids. They would eat them. They would just take their esrog and they would eat them. So I listened to a different rabbi who said, this is clearly referring to a bat and a baseball, that they're playing baseball with the lulav and esrog, right? You have a bat and you have a baseball, the lulav and the esrog. Not exactly what's going on here, but it's Rashi says they could use the esrog for some other purpose. Says Rashi, v'ein bedavar lo mishum gezel. There's no thievery involved. It's not going to be considered aser in any way. V'lo mishum darkei shoma. We're not going to consider it as if this is some kind of animosity that you're bringing up. But rather, shekach nagu mishum simcha, machmas simcha. This is what they used to do for simcha. They used to play with the lulav and the esrog. Now, that doesn't sound exactly sport-like. So before you judge Rashi's comments, let's look at Tosos on the same daf. Because Tosos comes along and says, kach perish kontras, he quotes Rashi. We know Tosos was the grandson, the grandchildren of Rashi. So says Tosos, kach perish kontras, v'yesh lilmod mikan, and we can learn from here, la'osan bachrim sherochvim besusim likras chasan. These young guys, these koel guys, I don't know, bachrim, young guys who ride on horses to greet a chassan. What does that mean, they ride on horses? V'nilchamim zeim zeh, i.e. jousting. They would joust at Jewish weddings. You know, nowadays they have those people that juggle fire and they have those people that do crazy things inside the circle. So it used to be that the Jewish kids, the boys, bachrim, not exactly underage, they're you know, older bachrim, they would actually play on horses and joust with each other. And what would happen when you joust with each other when you're on horseback? Koranes bigdo shel chavero. They would mistakenly rip the clothing of the other one. Omakalko lo suso. Or even they would injure the actual horse. And in that case, maybe you would think you would have to pay for the damage. So says, no, peturin. That's a ptur. You don't have to pay for hurting somebody else during such a jousting match. Shekach nagu machmas simchas chasan. This is all because of the joy of the chasan. They're trying to create some kind of joyous occasion, and they're doing so by playing a game. Right? So here you have an indication from Tosfos that at least they did this kind of sporting event. It's not exactly a sporting event that nowadays is very popular. Obviously, it's a little more dangerous, but maybe one could make the argument it's not as dangerous as football is, but not for now. But he says, Toso says that maybe it doesn't refer specifically to the older kids. Doesn't refer specifically to the older kids taking the younger kids lulav and esrog. Maybe it's referring to the younger kids doing it right away. The word miyad is the tricky word there. Is it from their hands or is it that they did it right away? Either way, they would then play with it, right? This is the end of Tosfos. If you look at the end of source number two, lefisha halulav aroch v'socha kinbo v'esrogein hayochlin. They would play with the lulav. You can imagine sort of like a sword fight with a lulav. They would play with it. Probably a little dangerous, but either way, that they would play with the lulav and esrog. Here you have a Gemara and Sukkah that basically implies that Jewish people used to play lulav and esrog. What exactly the game consisted of, I'm not sure. But Tosfos learns a halacha from it. Tosfos learns that if you injure somebody in the middle of a game, as long as it's for the sake of joy, entertainment, so that would be okay. So there you have it. You have an instance of actual sporting event where we learn a halacha that you don't have to pay for any damages that happen. The truth is that even if it's not for simcha, even if it's for actual competition, you would not be obligated because, at least according to the fact that both people are invested in that game, both people are, you know, aware of the possibility that you might get hurt. So then halachically, you don't actually have to pay for anything because everyone's assuming that they have the potential to lose out. There's another discussion that comes up in the postgame, that comes up early on, already from Gemara in the Yerushalmi in Tanis, that talks about playing sporting events, playing sports on Shabbos. Now, right, you're not going to really have much in terms of a conversation of playing sports generally because there's no tension there, right? Halacha is always about, can you do something when you think you couldn't do it, right? If there's something that you go, right, the Gemara never talks about, are you allowed to drink water? Because, well, I guess maybe on fast days it talks about it or something like that. But the Gemara doesn't talk about, you know, things that obviously you're allowed to do. So the Gemara doesn't talk about playing sports in terms of exercise or in terms of, in terms of physical strengthening and stuff like that. But it talks about it in terms of times where maybe you wouldn't be allowed to. And there, in those situations where there's a tension, you can really understand what's the value of it, right? When there's something against it, this is getting a little too in the weeds, but logically, if you think about, you know, how does Chazal view the value of sports? So you can only judge the value of something when there's something working against it, right? When there's a reason to say that maybe you shouldn't do it. So the question is, well, is there value in doing it even though there's a reason that you shouldn't do it? That would really indicate to us, that would express to us whether they'd be allowed to do such a thing. So if you look at source number 3, the Gemara tells us, the Shulchan Aruch Paskins, it's not really a Gemara, the Gemara in Yerushalmi talks about it a little bit, implies it. So the Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch says, Asur l'schok b'shabes v'yom tov b'kador. This is an actual line in the Shulchan Aruch. Lest you think this is some kind of modern book. No, this is the real Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Kairo. You're not allowed to play with a ball on Shabbos. Why in the world would you not be allowed to play with a ball? Whatever the reason is, says the Rama, V'yesh matir, and here in Poland, we play ball. V'nagul l'hakel. The minhag over here in Poland is that we play ball on Shabbos. What in the world? What's going on? Playing ball on Shabbos, that doesn't sound very Shabbos-tic. So what's going on? If you look at the Aruch HaShulchan there, so the Gemara says, Hakadurim shemesach gimahem he mukza. The balls might be mukza. Why would they be mukza? Shaharei enam re'uyim l'tashmish. They're not usable. There's no functional utility for them on Shabbos itself. Ve'av gam l'chasos pem kelim. Even if you would use the ball to cover up a kli that maybe is holding some food that you need for Shabbos, enam re'uyim ibnei shehem etunafim metit ve'afar hanidbak behem be'es haschok. Right, the balls are all dirty because they've been rolling in the mud, and therefore you wouldn't even want to use them. Right, it's like sticks and stones, which you're not allowed to use on Shabbos. So maybe there would be us, or it would be muktzah to use such things. Umimela says the Aruch HaShulchan, Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein, in the aser lischok bechadurim b'Shabbos. Maybe that's why it's forbidden to use these balls on Shabbos because they're muktzah. They don't serve a significant function. That is presumably the opinion of the Shulchan Aruch. There are other possibilities, by the way. The Gemara talks about things rolling out of the Erev, and maybe, you know, we make a gezerah against that so that people don't come to bring it and carry it outside of the Erev, from outside to inside the Erev, or outside of the Erev for four amos, 6 feet worth. So there are other possible reasons that other Mefarshim talk about. But the Aruch HaShulchan continues. V'yesh Omrim, says the Aruch HaShulchan, remember the Aruch HaShulchan is an Ashkenazic posek. So when the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, is approaching this halacha, he's approaching it through the lens of the Rama. Rav Moshe Isserles in Poland is the Ashkenazic posek. So the Aruch HaShulchan a few hundred years later, but nonetheless, he's now going to try to justify why it would be okay to play ball on Shabbos. V'yesh Omrim, Dekev and Dereuyin Lischok, because they are usable. There is a utility in using the ball for joy, for entertainment. Ubahaschok, and with the entertainment itself, ein iser l'mis'angim bazeh. There's no strict prohibition when you're actually playing with the ball. Lefikach mutarim betilta u'mis'achakim bahem. And therefore, you'd be allowed to move the ball and play with the ball. What's going on here? Now, there are different ways you can understand this machlokas, but one of the reasons or one of the implications that could be going on here is whether we assume there's utility in playing sports. Right? You have Shabbos. Shabbos is a day where we rest. We try to enjoy the day. There's a concept of Oneg Shabbos. So what constitutes enjoyment? Says the Shulchan Aruch, playing ball is not the kind of enjoyment we want you to have on Shabbos. Says the Aruch HaShulchan, it might not be the best kind of enjoyment, but it's enough of an enjoyment that we'd allow somebody to do it. It's not going to be usher to do it. It's not something we'd encourage somebody to do. We probably would discourage it, but we can't say that it's usher, because a person could enjoy it, and sports can bring about that enjoyment. It's not bad enough that we wouldn't allow you to play sports on Shabbos. Now, obviously, there's a discussion about whether or not that's what you want to spend your Shabbos doing. Shabbos is not about playing sports. Obviously, it's about holier things. It's about resting. It's about family. It's about recognizing Hashem as the creator of the world, of reflecting on that fact, reflecting on how you're doing and your contributions to the world. And maybe playing ball is against the spirit of Shabbos. But the Aruch HaShulchan is saying it's not against the literal law of Shabbos. The Aruch HaShulchan then says that maybe it's only okay on Yontif, because as what I said before, because it's about Erev, and on Yontif, there's not really an issue with Erev. But says the Aruch HaShulchan again, Ve'enu ikar, v'chein ha'menig l'hakel, we're lenient to allow people to play ball on Shabbos. Says the Mishnah Berurah in a different place in the Shulchan Aruch, actually by Yontif Halachas. He quotes the Maharshal in source number 5 here. The Maharshal says, the Davar Temahu, it's crazy, it's a wonderment. Lahatir zeh de'ein bo tzorach hayom klal elas chok shel yiladim v'hanach lahem. If kids want to play ball, so let the kids play ball. Aval gdolim, for adults to play ball on Shabbos, to play with balls on Shabbos, shenogin came minhag rahu. That's a bad thing to do, says the Maharshal. It's bad to do. Now, it's unclear, does he mean bad to do generally? Or does he mean this is not how we should spend Yontif? We shouldn't spend Yontif playing ball. We should do other things on Yontif. Says the Marshal, the ein ze simcha v'til ella sichas yiladim v'kalus rosh. This is frivolity. This is the Mishnah Berurah quoting the Marshal. U'belav hachi ein din ze muskam l'kuli ama d'dasa machaber lesor. And generally, if it wasn't for the aspect of the children, it would be completely usher, according to the Shulchan Aruch. That's what the Mishnah Berurah quotes. Comes the Aruch HaShulchan again, in this place, to defend the meaning of playing ball on Shabbos. Says the Aruch HaShulchan in source number 6, V'kasav Rabbeinu HaRamah, T'mutter listok b'chador, afil b'shus harabim, af agav she'enu el atiyu ba'ama, akal shomel. Akan l'shama says Aruch HaShulchan, quoting the Maharshal, presumably, or referring to the Maharshal, V'yesh mitra'amim al zeh. Some people complain about this. She'ein zeh simcha v'til rak l'ketanim lo gedolim. This is for kids and not for adults. Says Aruch HaShulchan, u'p'emes. In truth, ein zeh tar omos. That's not a good complaint. De'kevan de'chaviv alav l'fi da'ato ha'shvela. Because the adult himself, maybe even if he has maybe a lower level concept of what Shabbos and Yontif is supposed to be, l'fi da'ato ha'shvela, because of his low level intellect, eich nimna mimenu, how could we hold back this enjoyment? This is how they would enjoy Yontif. This is how they would enjoy Shabbos. It would seem that maybe underneath this discussion is how we view sports. Is sports something which we could tolerate for the sake of allowing someone to enjoy the time of Yontif and Shabbos? Or do we see it as something which is completely unjustified? This is for kids. It's not for people who are upstanding Jews. And obviously, ideally, this is not how anyone should spend their Shabbos and Yontif. The question is whether it's usher. Shulchan Aruch seems to say that sports is not justified as an activity for Shabbos and Yontif, because it's you're generally frivolous, and whereas the Aruch HaShulchan says it could be okay. Yeah, Leonard.
Yeah, I have to assume, though, from this, that he's talking specifically about Yontif, because he says, afilu b'shus harabim. How could you possibly justify b'shus harabim on Shabbos?
So, he's actually quoting the Ramah here, and it's a bit of a mystery why the Ramah says this phrase, even Rosh Hashanah, because it is talking about Yontif. if you look at the Shulchan Aruch, it's talking about Yatif. I don't want to go through the whole thing, but there is a chiddush of a Ritva that says that that implies that maybe we would apply some chumras of Shabbos to Yatif for the sake, I think, of bolstering the observance of Shabbos. But we do paskin against that. We paskin that we do not have Erev on Shabbos, but this Ramah is actually referring to Yantif. It's a bit of a mystery. And Nukalino Sekalim there on Tuf Kuf Yud Ches, why the Ramah even brings up that phrase, it's very strange. Very strange. Yeah, sir.
There's a sign outside Julie's office that's been there for years,
yeah,
saying that a certain town was destroyed because of ball playing on Shabbos. Can you comment on that?
So that's what this is based on. I don't know what sign you're talking about. But that's Gemara, the Gemara in Tanis Parakeh tells us, I think Parakeh or Parakimel, that there was a certain town that was destroyed because they played ball on Shabbos. And that's what this is all based on. It comes from that Gemara. How does the Ramah understand that Gemara? I'm not really sure. You know, one of the other discussions that I didn't get into here is whether or not playing ball back then was something more than just playing ball. Oftentimes, theaters and coliseums not only involved, you know, just innocent ball playing, but it involved murder. It involved a more aggressive activity than just. Throwing a ball back and forth. It was actually possible Avodah Zarah involved also, if I remember correctly. Gemara Megillah talks about theaters and coliseums. So there was more going on. I'm not sure if that's how he would understand it, but I definitely know that that is a concept back then, that they would, that their sporting events often involved, you know, actual terrible things like Shvichus Damim and Avodah Zarah. So when you look at it in the context of that, so that's a problem. How exactly that works within the concept of Shabbos, which I think the Gemara says explicitly, is unclear why that would be specifically a problem on Shabbos. But maybe it's also because of its sort of connection with those aggressive or heretical activities. Not sure. That's a good question. I'd have to look into why the Ramah says that. It's a good question. So that is definitely the Gemara in Tanis. It's interesting that the Shulchan Aruch doesn't mention that, or the Nosek Kalim don't really focus on that too much. I looked around because I know that it's based on that, but it doesn't really seem to be a discussion. Lastly, in terms of professional sports, Rav Moshe Feinstein was once asked. It's a great mystery. Who exactly asked this question? But somebody asked Rav Moshe Feinstein, is somebody allowed to pursue a career in professional sports? I don't know which halachically abiding Jew was so, you know, worried about this. Can I play sports professionally? I wonder if he ever made something of himself. But in athletics, I'm sure he made something of himself in other ways. But so this is what the Rav Moshe says in source number 7. Nishalti me'achadim mutter lo'isparnitz me'meskach zirigas ha'kadurim. Shenikra bal balaz. You see that in the beginning of source number 7. Beis aleph lamed. Bal. That's where Moshe Feinstein talks about sports. He calls it ball. So sheyesh lachash l'sakana. Maybe it's a dangerous thing. Maybe Jewish people shouldn't engage in playing football and putting their lives at risk. So long story short, Rav Moshe Feinstein points out that there's a Gemara in Bava Metzia that basically explains that a person is allowed to work as a harvester, of, you know, climbing trees and putting their life in danger for the sake of making a parnassa. So he learns from there that even if sporting, you know, activities might put you at risk for some kind of injury, that would still be justified. A nice Jewish boy doesn't have to always become a doctor or a lawyer. You could actually do some. You can involve some level of risk to your health for the sake of your parnassa. He doesn't talk about it generally as a luxury or as an extracurricular activity, but Rav Moshe does say that one would be allowed to pursue it for the sake of money. Not too many Orthodox Jews have actually, you know, made that transition. Speaking of, you know, my relationship with the Shones actually goes further back than simply, you know, coming here to the Young Israel of Oak Park. When I was a kid, my father was a basketball coach of a Jewish school's basketball team named Talmudical Academy, and Brian Schoen was on that team. Talked a little bit about the funeral, how Larry was, you know, a mekayim of Chanoch l'nar al pi darko, that each kid had his own derech, and Larry was very committed to making sure his kids went to the right schools. And Brian ended up going to this place called Talmudical Academy. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Brian's senior year, maybe Aaron could correct me, I believe Brian's senior year was Tamir Goodman's sophomore year.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, so if people remember Tamir Goodman was probably one of the few Orthodox Jews who made national publicity for his basketball skills. And Brian played with him when Brian was a senior. Tamir was in 10th grade. He made more publicity in 11th grade. But I lived through that whole up and down, that whole drama with Tamir Goodman. Featured in, I don't know, it was a 5-page spread in Sports Illustrated. I'm not sure Brian made any of the pictures. I don't remember. But that was the year after Brian, so I'm not really sure. But it is interesting that my association with that concept of Orthodox Jews, you know, making a foray into sporting activities in a professional sense actually goes, you know, my relationship goes back to Larry. I didn't remember Larry from back then, but I definitely had a relationship with a family. Yeah, Aaron.
My grandma has that article framed at his office.
Who?
Framed.
No. Larry has it in the office.
Oh, yeah?
That article is up in the office.
Yeah. It's a really a fascinating picture to have, you know, to have a picture of someone davening with tefillin on in the middle of Sports Illustrated. It is crazy that such a thing actually exists. I remember the issue. Terrell Davis was on the cover. Anyone who knows who Terrell Davis was. Either way, Terrell Davis was the running back for the Broncos. Either way, fascinating history, just on a personal level, with professional sports and professional athleticism with the Shones goes way back beyond just this class. But now let's get in a little bit to the beginning of American Jewry in sporting. Now, the truth is that we could talk for a long time. We could talk for a long time and a bunch of different details, a bunch of different stories, things here and there about the history of sports and Jews in America. As you could probably imagine, so there's not a lot of orthodoxy involved. There's not a lot of halacha. There's not a lot of rabbinic debate in terms of sports in early American Jewry. It was mostly a secularized Jewish concept to engage, at least in public sport. But a couple interesting notes that really led the way for Jewry in general to sort of, you know, feel comfortable in the public eye in that sense. So there was actually a well-known boxer in London. This goes all the way back to the end of the 18th century. In 1790, I don't know people might be more, and people are definitely more expert in this. I said when I tried out a couple years ago, when I stayed at Larry's house and tried out a couple years ago, it was this Shabbos, Parshas Vayigash. So I said back then, I don't think the role of a Rav is to be an expert in anything. Right, I'm not going to be the expert in any specific topic. I'm going to be the one that's invested in every topic. And so too here, I'm not an expert in Jewish American history, as I've talked about in these classes before, and specifically with sporting issues. I'm not 100, I'm not the expert either. But I invested in the topic, and I found a few different interesting articles, a few different interesting concepts. I'm sure if people have what to add, they're free to add what they want. But we're going to go a little bit into some things that I found. So one interesting thing that I saw in London. There was a man by the name of Daniel Mendoza. He actually was, in some ways, observant. Not really sure to what extent. He was born in 1764, and he had a bar mitzvah. And after his bar mitzvah, he tried to, he tried a couple different jobs, but he kept losing the job because he kept getting in fights. So he figured to himself, well, it seems like I'm a better fighter than I am a professional of any other sort. So he goes into boxing, and he actually becomes one of the most well-known boxers in England. He really, at least at the end of his life, he claimed that he revived the sport of boxing in England. Unclear exactly how history is on his side on that. But one thing that he is known for is the science of boxing. He was a very small guy. He was 5'7", right? You wonder, like, how could a Jew, you know, rise to prominence in boxing? He was only 5'7", I think 160 pounds or something like that. And he was known for the scientific approach to boxing. He would use different defensive mechanisms to avoid punches and to tire the other guy out. And he would use a sequence of short and continuous punching as his strategy. He was ultimately crowned the national boxing champion of England after he beat. He became the heavyweight champion. I don't know what that means, heavyweight champion, when you're 160 pounds, but he was the heavyweight champion of all of England, and he held that title for about a year. He was the first Jew to ever become the heavyweight boxing champion of England. The reason I mention is because many people in his general orbit actually immigrate afterwards to America, and they start the Jewish boxing scene in New York City. And then there are German immigrants that also started. So he was really sort of a pioneer in, I guess, the Western world of sports. And at that time, not all of the Western world was actually very permissive of Jews to be part of the public eye like that. In London, they had a certain liberation of freedom of religion in that sense, and he was able to rise in the ranks. It happens to be that he had some ups and downs later on in life in terms of controversy because of rising ticket prices, and then there was an interesting and an unfortunate boycott of the boxing sport because of it, and he was blamed as sort of the Jew who's trying to, extract the shekels from everybody else and stuff like that. There's very unfortunate publicity that you can find online about the end of his life, or I guess the sort of the peak of his career. He was known to have revived the sport, and then he was blamed for it afterwards. There's also an interesting concept, complication apparently about his money and where it went, and he became poor, and he had to write books to make his money back. He actually was put into prison because he owed too much debt. But either way, that's Daniel Mendoza of England. When we get into America, so some prominent pioneers in American sports. I don't know if people know these names. I didn't know these names. There was a guy named Lip Pike. Lipman Pike was apparently one of the first professional athletes in American sports. In what way? If this is just a quote I found, the biographical history of baseball by Daniel Dewey and Nicholas Acacella, I don't know. Lipman Pike was one of the first players to be acknowledged as a professional. What happened? While others had certainly been paid before 1866, Pike, along with two teammates on the ostensibly amateur Philadelphia Athletics, was ordered to appear before a judiciary committee of the governing National Association of Baseball players to answer charges that he had accepted $20 for his services. $20 in 1866 was a lot of money, but apparently he was being paid under the table because it was forbidden to be paid as a baseball player at that time. Although the matter was dropped when nobody bothered to show up for the hearing, right? Like you get a driving ticket and no one shows up, so you get a pass. So here too, he was called to court and then nobody showed up. So although the matter was dropped and nobody bothered to show up for the hearing, the incident exposed for the first time the widespread practice of paying supposedly amateur players. So this guy, Lipman Pike, was apparently a trailblazer in being paid as a professional athlete. I don't know if people know this book, the well-known book here, Great Jews in Sports by Robert Slater, somewhat of a popular book. But he goes through Pike's whole career. He had a pretty impressive impressive stat line. For those baseball fanatics or people that are familiar with what it means to be a good baseball player, so he batted in 1880. He batted .356. He actually hit 5 or maybe 6 home runs in one game, which back then was easier to do than it is today. Apparently, apparently the end score of that game was 42-27. So it's still impressive nonetheless to get 5 home runs, but it wasn't something that people weren't able to do generally. They scored 42 runs. So unclear exactly how what was wrong with the pitching back then. But either way, he played until he was 42 years old. He actually joined the New York Mets. For those Mets fans, so first of all, sorry, but second of all, you have an interesting Jewish heritage in Lippmann Pike being on the Mets. He wasn't very good. He only lasted a little bit on the Mets, but nonetheless, that's a real professional baseball team. He was actually considered, even though obviously the Hall of Fame didn't exist at that point, he was considered later on when the Hall of Fame actually did begin. I think it's, where's the Baseball Hall of Fame? Cooperstown, right? So if the Cooperstown Baseball Hall of Fame, actually, I think one of their first votes, he got one vote to be inducted into the Hall of Fame as the first professional, one of the first professional baseball players. He didn't make it in because it was, 60, 70 years until they made it. I forgot exactly when. But either way, interesting to start off the Jews, the first professional baseball player in history. And something else in the turn of the century, the 19th century, happens, which I found interesting, not because of anti-Semitism per se, but because of just natural discrimination. It's not that anybody hated the Jews, and that's why they weren't allowed in certain clubs, but it was simply because of the way that American society was developing as a predominantly Christian culture. In the 1850s, there is something called the Young Men's Hebrew Association. Now, some of you might know a little bit of history. I'm sure David Barth could probably tell us all about this, that this is actually the precursor to the JCC movement. Jewish community centers were once upon a time called the Young Men's Hebrew Association. They were called the Y for short. You might know the name the Y from the YMCA. The truth is that the Young Men's Hebrew Association was created before the YMCA, not by much, but by a few months, at least here in America. I think the YMCA and the YMHA actually existed back in Europe. I'm not 100% sure. But what is interesting about the development of the YMHA vis-a-vis the YMCA, as you know, the C in YMCA refers to Christian. And therefore, Jews weren't particularly, welcome in the Christian group. But it wasn't at the beginning, it wasn't exclusively a sporting or sort of country club type atmosphere. Originally, it was really for literacy, that Jews, it was sort of like the Sunday school for Jews, a community Sunday school of sorts. And remember, this is the end of the 19th century. If you remember our last class, we talked about the 1850s in Cincinnati. So it's not exactly clear that Reform Judaism actually existed, but there was certainly a lack of education in early American Jewry, and the YMHA was originally a literacy group where they would teach how to read and write Hebrew. They sometimes even had davening at these places. It was a communal association. It was a club of sorts, but it was non-denominational. And what's interesting about it is that while the YMCA developed in its own way, the YMHA sort of borrowed some of their cultural developments also. And if you see here, here's a book is an article. Not sure when it was originally written, but it's in a book called The Publications of American and Jewish Historical Society, which is a sort of a compilation of older writings from early American history, early American Jewish history. And I think we quoted it once. If you remember the class. I think it was maybe Memorial Day, one of the legal holiday classes. We talked about reading from a chumash instead of reading from a Sefer Torah. If people they don't know how to lane, so we quoted from this publication of American Jewish Historical Society. It's sort of a compilation of different articles. So this is a rundown of the history of the Young Men's Hebrew Association. The article's over 100 pages long, so I did not go through all of the nits and crannies of it. But what you see here is an interesting contrast to what happens by the YMHA vis-a-vis the YMCA. The indirect influence of the Young Men's Christian Associations upon the early YMHA should be noted. From their founding in 1851, that's the exact date that we talked about last time in Cincinnati. Remember the different rabbis that came to Cincinnati to try to develop the community, ultimately turning into a Reform congregation, two Reform congregations in 1855. If you remember that whole class, you can still, listen to it online. But in 1851, when they created the YMHA, the Young Men's Christian Association during the Civil War by the organization of the United States Christian Commission to serve the armies. At the close of the Civil War, the number of YMCA's association was only 60. Within 10 years, by 1874, the number of YMCA's grew to 950. The YMCA apparently had some kind of enrollment process within the war itself, and therefore became more popular. The Jewish community in the United States could not fail to be impressed by the new movement. A handful of YMHAs came into existence in the 1850s, but immediately after the Civil War, their number began to multiply. The liberal rabbis of the time were deeply interested. It is interesting the way that this article phrases it. I'm not exactly sure the angle of the article or the religious assumptions of the article, but the way that this is phrased is very interesting. The liberal rabbis of the time, meaning those who aren't focused as much on religion as they are on culture, the liberal rabbis of the time were deeply interested in the development and not only assisted actively in the organization of new YMHAs, but in many instances assumed the office of president. We've talked about a couple of these people before. Isaac Lesser was involved in the YMHA movement. Who else was involved? Somebody else that we talked about before. I think Isaac Mayer Wise is mentioned in this article. At the same time, they were careful to point out the difference in emphasis between Jewish and Christian Y's, right? Known as going to the Y, right? This was due partly to the fact that the early Young Men's Christian Association was frequently regarded as an evangelical organization, a movement for the reform of criminals, a temperance society, and an agency attempting to enforce Sunday blue laws. Nevertheless, right, that's the YMCA. On one side is YMCA. Nevertheless, the Young Men's Christian Association movement accelerated the organization of the parallel Jewish movement and to a lesser extent influenced the philosophy of early YMHAs. In the first place, the sectarianism of the Young Christian Association was translated into YMHA, into a positive attitude towards Jewish affairs, in place of the passive interest in things Jewish apparent in the literary and social clubs of the period. I find this sentence to be very interesting as a rabbi, and for anybody who's sort of involved in Jewish communal leadership. What does it mean when it says here, it was instrumental in creating a positive attitude toward Jewish affairs in place of the passive interest in things Jewish apparent in the literary and social clubs of the period? Meaning, Jews didn't want to daven as much as they wanted to play, right? Jews wanted to be involved socially and culturally more than they wanted to be involved religiously. And therefore, these clubs were instrumental in bringing people at least a semblance of Judaism into their life. At least they were involved with Jewish people. They were involved Jewishly in this exclusive association, being that they couldn't be involved in the Young Men's Christian Association. Secondly, the Young Men Christian Association's plan for a single unified association in each community was reflected in the YMHA, concept of a community-wide organization offering a common platform for all Jews in the community, meaning it was a place where all Jews could come, right? So while it was segregated from the YMCA, the Jewish community integrated and was inclusive of all Jews in the entirety of the community when it created the YMHA. The YMHA inherited its educational facilities, the library and the reading room and the auditoriums, from the literary associations, and its recreational facilities, the gymnasium, bowling alleys, and billiard rooms, from the social clubs of the period. So basically what it's saying is that the YMHA played off of the YMCA, right? It wasn't exactly anti-Semitism that excluded the Jews from being part of the YMCA, but it was just the nature of having a Christian organization. And in response to that, they created a Jewish association. So not exactly anti-Semitism that led them to promote the YMHA, which obviously involved a lot of athleticism and cultural, theater and sports, as you see here, bowling and billiard. Whether you call those sports is probably up to you. Generally, people like to make the claim that it's a sport if it's shown on ESPN, because the letter S stands for sporting. But I'm always a little bit wary of that rule, because ESPN shows a lot of things that I don't consider a sport. But that's a debate for another time. Either way, so this is an instance where the Jewish community played off of the being excluded from the Christian community, not necessarily because of anti-Semitism, but just because of natural exclusions. Something happens in... Is this the next thing I want to talk about? I think I want to talk about this next. Hold on. Something happens in 1919. So just a disclaimer, a little bit of a disclaimer here. The general anti-Semitism that Jews faced in American sporting, it was not really an outgrowth from the top down, right? It wasn't like people that ran the sport or ran the associations were particularly hostile towards Jews. There might be, you know, individual instances, especially when it comes to country clubs and things like that, where Jews were excluded. But in terms of professional sports, it never was explicit that Jews were excluded in any formal way. What is clear, however, is that there was anti-Semitism from the sort of the lay people that were playing in the sports. So here's an interesting article from Jews in American Sports from Jewish Currents in 2011, where it goes through some of that history. In boxing, there was some stuff which we talked about before. But one of the interesting Jews were central in the creation of basketball also. But one thing that was somewhat interesting in terms of basketball is not really how basketball viewed the Jews, because the Jews really were very, very prominent in early basketball development. But what was interesting about it is how some in the media portrayed it. So if you look here is a quote from that article I just showed you from Bennett Maraskin in 2011, which quotes one newspaper from the Daily News, which talked about Jews in basketball in the following way. In 1929, as Jews began to enter basketball in large numbers, the Vorwärts described it as a Jewish sport. Basketball is a Jewish sport. What does it mean, Jewish sport? In which brains, nimble thinking, and speedy coordination between mind and muscle are more effective than a mere physical brawn and power. Meaning Jews aren't very athletic, but they're schemy. When the Jewish domination of the sport became apparent in the 1930s, a Daily News columnist Paul Galico wrote that basketball appeals to the Hebrew because the game places a premium on an alert, scheming mind, flashy trickiness, artful dodging, and general smart aleckness. Neither the follow nor the anti-Semitic assertions were helpful, of course, but they reflected how Jews dominated Jew ball, as basketball was colloquially known during the 1930s and 40s. Which is either positive or negative. At least the way that that phrasing by that author sounds like it's negative, obviously. But perhaps the greatest instance of early anti-Semitism in sports was something called the scandal of the 1919 Black Sox. Their name was not the Black Sox, but their name was the White Sox. Now, you might know this baseball team. It still exists today. The Chicago White Sox, and apparently in 1919, right? People might know there are different films about this. I think it's called Eight Men Out or Nine Men Out, right? Say It Ain't So, Joe, Shoeless Joe Jackson. The movie Field of Dreams is based on this premise that they want to keep playing baseball because they weren't allowed to play anymore. Ultimately, what happened was that they were in the World Series, and I think part of the background is, people might know this better than me, part of the background was that baseball players weren't paid very well. And even though they were in the World Series, they weren't really getting their financial due. And therefore, instead of making their money off of playing the game, they made their money off of gambling on the game. And apparently the players themselves threw the game. Now, I'm sure there's a lot of controversy behind this, who was in on it, who wasn't in on it, but people probably know this better than I do. In 1919, they basically lost the game on purpose in exchange for money from a gambling syndicate known as Arnold Rothstein. That last name might sound very Jewish to you, because he was Jewish. And this did not help the Jewish profile in American sports. But essentially what it did was it became the general basis for some anti-Semitic remarks. And none other than Henry Ford's own Dearborn Independent took the opportunity to really discuss this anti-Semitism in the paper. I think it's still around. Is Dearborn Independent still around? People know? I don't know. We know about Dearborn, and we know about the controversial history of Henry Ford. I'm sure a lot of people here could tell me more about Henry Ford's alleged anti-Semitism or lack thereof. I've actually had many conversations with many congregants already about Henry Ford and how he viewed the Jews. It seems to me, I might be wrong about this, it seems to me that he was an opportunistic Jew hater or lover, depending on what they availed to him, what they gave him as opportunities, much like Napoleon's mixed bag view of the Jews was. But either way, so here in the Independent, you can see the title here: Jewish Gamblers Corrupt American Baseball, the Cleanest Sport Near Its Doom. Right, this is in 1919, right? You know, accusing the Jews of destroying baseball, the cleanest sport near its doom from too much Jew. Baseball has passed under control of the sport spoilers. Can it be saved? Wow, what an accusation. This is the actual newspaper, by the way, from September of 1921. Right after the whole litigation of the World Series and everything, right? The World Series is played at the end of 1919. So the fact that it came under all these lawsuits and things like that only sort of bubbled out over in 1920 and then 1921. So this is September of 1921. There are men in the United States who say that baseball has received its death wound and is slowly dying out of the list of respectable sports. This is classic anti-Semitism, sort of fear-mongering over the Jews. It's dying out because the Jews are involved. There are other men who say that American baseball can be saved if a clean sweep is made of Jewish influence, which has just dragged it through a period of bitter shame and demoralization. Right? So it's either going to die, or it's only going to survive if you get rid of the Jews. Whether baseball as a first-class sport is killed and will survive only as a cheapjack entertainment, or whether baseball possesses sufficient intrinsic character to rise in righteous wrath and cast out the danger that menaces it, will remain a matter of various opinion. But there is one certainty, there is one thing for sure, namely that the last and most dangerous blow dealt baseball was curiously notable for its Jewish character. Wow. That the Jews are responsible for killing baseball. This is 1919, yet only lesser Jews were indicted. Inevitably, the names of other Jews appeared in press accounts, and people wondered who they were. A Jewish judge presided. Jewish lawyers were prominent in both sides of the cases. Numerous strange things occurred. But strangest of all is the fact that although American fans felt that something epochal had happened in baseball, few really know what it is. There has been time enough for others to tell the truth if they were so disposed, right? This is basically 2 years later. Many sport editors have come as near telling it to as their newspapers would permit them. But it becomes daily more evident that if the whole matter is to be laid bare so that Americans may know where to look for danger, the Dearborn Independent will have to do it. Right? And another classic anti-Semitic strategy. Nobody else is talking about it because they're being forced to not talk about it. Right, the Dearborn Independent is the only one that really is talking about it because they're the ones that are brave enough. They have the courage to really, you know, expose the Jews. Now, obviously, that's not true. The reason it's not being talked about is because it's not a Jewish conspiracy. But they're trying to promote it in that sense, and that's why they're sort of presenting it this way. It's, as you can see, we're not going to go through the whole article, but it's obviously unfortunate the way that they spun the whole thing. Jews are not good sportsmen, exploiting and corrupting clean sports. what else here? Some strange occurrences favor Jews, right? They're just piecing together things and making a claim at it. Who's who of Jews in baseball, right? Talking about the lures. Meet Mr. Rothstein, the real estate man, right? So Rothstein was the one behind all of it, and therefore that sort of is the nail in the coffin. So obviously there's a lot to talk about there, but also obviously they were wrong, right? They were using it as an exploitation of Jews for the sake of creating this backdrop of Jews ruining baseball. And obviously the Jews overcome that, they get past that, and as is clearly shown through the different examples that we said today, Jews were only targeted because of their prominence, right? The basketball was called Jew ball because of how good they were at it, not because they were in any way exploiting the sport. And the Jews, although in the background there are Jews involved in the Black Sox scandal, it obviously didn't turn into any crazy debacle of the sport. And it was just an opportunity for anti-Semites to sort of take advantage of that scene and make a stir. In the end of the day, as we know, there are some very prominent Jewish stars that come through sports. And Mirz Hashem, next week, we'll pick up with that history next week on January 1st. And through that, another, again, sponsored in memory and in honor, the Ilui Neshama of Larry. And then we'll talk a little bit more on the positive side. This has been a little bit on the negative side. Jews being left out of country clubs. Jews being accused of only being good at basketball because they're schemy. Jews being accused of leveraging boxing in London because they want to take over the sport. And they're greedy. And then ultimately with the Black Sox scandal, all of these scandals, you know, were just basically, as you can imagine, were attempts to paint the Jewish involvement of the sport as being really some kind of conspiracy. I mean, really all it was Jews coming to their own in terms of sports and athleticism. But thank you, Big Els. But in actuality, it was just because the Jews were growing in the sport that people felt threatened by them. As it is with any profession that anti-Semitism creeps up in, once the Jews take prominence in that arena. But next week we'll talk more on the positive side. Where do we find the most sort of Jewish examples? Obviously, Sandy Koufax comes to mind. Hank Greenberg comes to mind. We'll talk a little bit about the background of those instances where Judaism played more of a prominent role than just athleticism. I'm sure people have a lot to talk about, and we could probably continue the conversation. Anything anybody wants to has a burning desire to add in terms of the history that they know of, in terms of early American history. And people know anything that sticks out by them. No? So Mirz Hashem will continue next week talking about sports figures in America more prominently in terms of the Judaism involved than the anti-Semitism involved. Mirz Hashem will continue that next week. Thank you all for joining, and thank you for honoring Larry's memory in this way. Mirz Hashem, our learning at the beginning of this year and next week's year will become Le'iloi Neshama of Larry, of Leibish Velvel Ben Yisrael Zisha. Thank you all. Have a wonderful rest of the day, a wonderful, meaningful fast. And just remember, you cannot eat until after Kiddush at earliest 5:41. Mincha today is at 4:40 to allow for a little extra time to lane. But besides that, everyone should be well. Stay safe out in the snow. We now have Daf Yomi here, so people are free to stay on the line. But we're gonna transition into Pesachim Daf Lamed Dalet for those who want. Thank you all for joining.